Welcome to our Thursday, June 18th edition of Irish Illustrated Insider. I'm Tim O'Malley, joined today by Pete Sampson of The Athletic and Drew Mentock of Irish Illustrated. Guys, before we get to gambling in sports, recruiting in sports, we're going to throw around words like bipartisan committees and Senate Commerce Committees and amendments. Should be a real hoot here to start off segment one, but that's what goes on in June, and this is the story of college football. Drew Mentock, as you wrote for Irish Illustrated, Notre Dame director of athletics, Pete Pavakwa, sent a letter of support to U.S. Senators Ted Cruz and Maria Cantwell, co-sponsors of the Protect College Sports Act. And today, actually, since then, I had to look up what a bill's second markup period is, but that is what's happening today by the Senate Commerce Committee. And the basis of this act is great. Hopefully, it won't get bogged down into every little bit of minutia that can happen.
Unfortunately, I think it probably will get bogged down into every bit of minutia that can happen. But yeah, I think, as you said, Pete Pavakwa he testified in front of this committee 2 weeks ago. This letter in support, I think, is just kind of reiterating some of his points that he feels are important, which is including like protecting Olympic sports and women's sports and kind of getting some of the bad actors that he's calling them, which is, you know, agents right now can charge whatever fees they want. I think this bill, at least in previous iteration, had that at 5%. So he, I think, is supportive of it. I think Notre Dame's in a good position where they're fine regardless, even if this goes to like a super league down the road or something like that. But I think Notre Dame's making it clear that their preference is that they do get some sort of legislation passed that they kind of keeps more of the status quo. Obviously, players will still get paid, but doesn't disrupt the sport and turn a bunch of these other sports into club sports.
I mean, I think it's rational that you can get to a one-time transfer. You know, I think that the media rights is a little bit stickier. NIL is probably still sticky, but it you know, we're at a spot where I had somebody compare where NIL is to, remember Sam Bradford got drafted, I think, by the Rams, and he was sort of like the last rookie contract that was so out of whack with, you know, what the veterans were making that people were just like, wait a minute, let's rethink this and walk back. And I think that's sort of where NIL is right now. It's, you know, you guys talked to Mike Martin, I've talked to a bunch of GMs. It's like when it costs $1 million to get a five-star freshman who might not even play, it's just like out of whack with where I think an efficient business or how it would operate. So we'll see. It passed out of committee today, and that still does not mean it will be brought to the floor of the Senate for a vote. Does not mean it will get to the floor of the House for a vote. There's still a long way to go, and I think we've seen a lot of like twists and turns to this point.
Since we gathered on Monday, the Brendan Sorsby saga has ended with Sorsby mutual parting the ways, it appears, and he entered the supplemental draft. Guys, who is your favorite supplemental draft pick in history? Because I think Brian Bosworth takes the cake for me.
I could barely name another one. Was it like Rob Moore, a wide receiver from who I think played in the league for quite a while? Yeah. That's about it. Those are, I think, the only supplemental draft picks I can name.
I totally forgot Terrell Pryor. Terrell Pryor is the most recent one I remember. Yeah. And for Ohio State fans, Chris Carter, by the way, was a supplemental draft.
The only
reason I knew about the supplemental draft as a kid is back in the day when you weren't allowed to have agents and you didn't get to pay for players. Actually, the word agent got you suspended immediately. You're ineligible immediately. Just saying the word agent got you ineligible back then. But Braxton Banks, Notre Dame's fullback, hired an agent, wanted to not go in the draft, and he had to go the supplemental route. So that's how far we've come in college athletics, Drew. You can't say the word agent, and now if you don't have an agent, you're losing out on a lot of money.
Yeah, and I think that's something that does need to get changed too, because now, I mean, yeah, high school players are referring people to their agents or representatives now too, and there really is no guardrails for that, so it really has kind of changed dramatically.
Pete, you mentioned Mike Martin, and I wanted to bring this up to you. I don't think we talked about it on a podcast. You were the first one to talk to me a couple years ago for a certain really good defensive back recruit about a two-year deal for an incoming freshman. I asked Mike Martin about two-year deals. Do they make, you know, does it make sense? Because I was trying to figure out how it makes sense for Notre Dame. And he was quite frank about it. He's like, I think it makes a lot of sense for the player. Doesn't make a whole lot of sense for the universities, because the real issue is if you play well, you can just void your last year of your contract, ask for more money. And you have to, if you're a good player, they're going to give it to you.
Or leave. and get more money somewhere else.
That's the point. Yeah, get more money somewhere else.
Yeah, it's just it's a matter of, I think, security for the player to a certain extent, although the, like the school can void it as well. You know,
it's a bad look, though. It is a bad look for the
player. Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's a bad look. But, yeah, it was – I wrote a big story at The Athletic about – I just talked to like a half dozen GMs about, you know, the nature of where things are. The consensus was Notre Dame had a $40 million roster. Some, but one GM thought it was closer to $48 million. But that, like, to a man, all these GMs were quite impressed with how quickly Notre Dame has gone from a good NIL player to a top five, top eight NIL player. And Mike Martin, they spoke well of Mike Martin about how organized he was. Also felt like, you know, at Notre Dame, at least, there are some GMs who have autonomy. Mike Martin's not really one of them. Like Marcus Freeman is kind of the run in the show there. So yeah, the 2-year deal type stuff, the incentives, those are interesting to talk to GMs about some guys have all conference incentives. Some have statistical incentives. I've heard of weight incentives, either gaining it or losing it. So there's a lot of interesting, I think, verbiage in these contracts now where, like, I think we all can be adults and say, like, we're paying the players to play football.
Yeah, Mike Martin mentioned they don't have those at Notre Dame because it is a pay-for-play, but they do have, say, Doak Walker Award finalist. I think of one of those guys. So year-end awards, he also had a really interesting one. You mentioned staying. Like, he said staying healthy – They're not really in the practice of going after someone's contract. It can't football, obviously not enough football field injury. You can't do that. My point was guys off the field. He mentioned he's heard of academics. If you make certain strides in academics, you can get bonuses in that. And then I asked him, what about if you're flunk out? He goes, that voids everything. Everybody. Yeah. Everything. I was like, I'm glad to hear that if you flunk out, you do get it voided. That'd be kind of easy for a student. I mean, think about it. I guess you have to be eligible in January, so it's not as easy. But you could play an entire regular season without and not worrying about it. That makes things a little bit easier on the athlete. So, I guess that's been a lot of fun off-the-field talk, guys. I think we can go more off-the-field talk with some young high school players. But Pete Sampson and Drew Bedtok, Abraham Cisse, the first of six possible pledges. Pete, I'm not sure if you saw it listed by Tom Loy on our site. That was a heck of a message board post for people to get excited about at Irish Illustrated. But Drew, I feel like we've been talking about CC now for a month and a half. And after our podcast, of course, he did commit to Notre Dame.
Yeah, I mean, it's the second 5-star defensive end and rusher Notre Dame has picked up, assuming he signs. But just another really talented prospect. And we're starting to see Notre Dame, I feel like, would get the occasional guy here now that you have Bryce Young, Abraham Cisse and Ronnie Dunham potentially all on the same roster, assuming Young doesn't have a really good year this year and go pro, which that would be 3 5-star defensive ends, which I can't remember the last time Notre Dame has, you know, stacked a group like that before.
They're in a good spot. I mean, they're not going to, I saw Tom Lye's post. They're not going to go 6-for-6. I wouldn't think. They might go 5-for-6. I mean, it's possible. They're just in a really good spot right now. And I will say, like, in reporting out the story on talking to GMs about Notre Dame's roster, a couple of them referenced the 2 defensive tackles Notre Dame had committed from Chicago. So you can take that as you would like, but they're in a good spot with these guys. And like they're very aggressive NIL. They have a great product to sell on top of that with the head coach and the school. So maybe it shouldn't be that big of a surprise, but it's just a completely different. Well, it's a different aisle that Notre Dame's shopping down and recruiting right now. And it's like, you're just like, oh my gosh, you're just looking around and seeing top 100 5-star defenders seek out Notre Dame. It's just a different world that we're all living in here.
Do you think it's worth noting that the one that they're not doing as well with potentially is Caden Henderson, a 5-star linebacker who I think a lot of crystal balls are coming in for Texas A&M. He's one I think Notre Dame felt really good about a few days ago. And as we discussed on Monday, that is definitely a position of need. So getting Roman Igwebuke in the class, a linebacker from Mount Carmel in Chicago, now becomes imperative. And it does sound like they're trending well with him.
Pete, you and I and Tim Priester have talked about the need for linebackers in this cycle. You can hit the portal, but I did a quick study for next week's Monday Musings or maybe a standalone story. Do you want to name the last linebacker Notre Dame brought in the portal?
Oh, geez.
You have to make up a name because that's what they brought in the portal.
There wasn't even a walk-on.
There's walk like a offensive
Bobby Berger or something like that. Yeah, maybe he was a tight end.
Yeah, it's like, you know, all the walk-ons they bring in are special teams guys like Herleman and Tofelsky. They're going to play for sure. Yeah. You get some Grant Ristoffs of the world. And yeah, it's even if you got both Igwebuike and Henderson, you're still having bringing in two freshmen. It really matters on how much you can pay to retain Jaden Osbury, who doesn't have the NFL allure that a great half season by KVA would bring. So it's really about building for 2028, I guess, because Notre Dame would be in trouble at linebacker if they lose everybody. If Drake Bowen decides, if there's no 5-for-5, so Drake Bowen has to go. If Jaden Osbury decides he can make a lot more money somewhere else or try his luck at the pros, KVA, the only guy that has to come back is Faremo. And at that point, if it's a freshman, you better be as good as Caden Henderson to come play at Notre Dame, because if you're shopping down a different aisle, you're also not trying to get to the Sugar Bowl, back in the old days Sugar Bowl. This is like playoff time. And I don't know who you get in the portal that could be as good as Jaden Osbury. I think we talked about this briefly.
Yeah, BYU got a linebacker, Cade Uluave from Cal, who's getting some preseason All-American love.
Yeah.
So I know there are some guys out there, but I don't know how, as your point, that the market for him may have been huge or way bigger than we realized, because there aren't a ton of guys out there potentially.
I think that there were maybe 10 linebackers. I was going through, I think, the Athletics list of the top transfers at that position. I think there were 10 linebackers who transferred with 100 tackles last year. And I mean, linebacker is like such an unglamorous position compared to what it used to be. I think there are more guys out there than we realize. And also, like, you can create a guy getting in the portal if you work the right angles there. So if Marcus Freeman is the head coach, I really have very little concern about Notre Dame having a very good linebacker room. It just might not be as good as what the one that they have this season. And that's fine.
And they also know they might have to pay to retain some of these guys. Rasheem Biles was the other one from Pittsburgh. Went to
I'm sure
he was very expensive, though.
He went to Texas, right?
He went to Texas, yes.
Yeah,
Texas,
so it's Texas. Like nobody's going to Texas for free.
No, nor do they have, especially Hollywood Smothers, as it turns out. He didn't go to Texas for free either. We'll be back to talk about actual football, I believe. Segment 2, Burning Up the Boards. Welcome back to Segment 2, Burning Up the Boards. Our first question is from Padriac10. It seems like the Irish DBs may be the best bunch of the country, and the linebackers are a top 10 unit. But how comfortable are you that the defensive line can be an elite unit? And if so, do they need to get Freeman a statue? I think that's an inside Irish Illustrated.
Very comfortable. I'll be honest. Like, I wouldn't be surprised if the defensive line was better than the linebackers by the end of the year. I think this defensive line has a chance to be great. Not as good as the secondary. But if they ended up being better than the linebackers, that would not surprise me.
Interesting. I think even Greg McElroy listed Notre Dame's linebacker core as the top in the nation too. So I think they could have a top 10 to top 5 unit at all three levels of the defense next year. But I agree. I think there's a lot of reasons to be really optimistic about the defensive line. I know there's some slight depth concerns at defensive end, but I think, given the consistency we saw from even Rodney Dunham in practice this fall, I know we didn't see it necessarily from Keon Keeley, but then you have Pupukar Traore, who's a potential first rounder. Bryce Young has all the talent in the world. Like, they're and Coach Partridge, I think, coaching this group, and just some of the things we've heard about him teaching Jason One things pre-snap that he never knew before about lining up and leverage and things like that, that there might be a lot he can get out of this group that maybe was left on the table previously.
I feel like, to Pete's point, I think the linebackers will be better, but to your point, like, even a guy like, you're talking into November and December, even a guy like Iwatade can come in for 10 snaps by then. I'm just using him as an example, whereas you didn't have that possibility a couple years ago that someone could come in and give you 10 snaps of high leverage situation. We mentioned Logan Thomas because the weight situation, maybe there should be a clause for weight in his contract, Pete Sampson. But yeah, I really like the linebackers, because as much as I say Iwatade or Logan Thomas could help in November, KVA could help in November for the linebackers coming into their own as well. And if, I don't know if I have mentioned Madden Framo's name yet on this podcast, like I'm supposed to every podcast, but I really think Framo can take a job as well. So I'm high on all of them. I'm way higher on the defense than I am the offense, which doesn't matter, because Notre Dame's going to score on everybody in the first 6 games. Next question, speaking of mixing offense and defense, from Wash ND. I like this one. It's all over the board. Which of these is most likely to happen this season? Greathouse gets over 30 receptions. Kedron Young scores 5 rushing touchdowns. Talic gets 2 picks and 2 sacks. Teddy Girard throws his first touchdown pass.
I think I would go Talich 1. After that, I would go Greathouse 2, just based on like the opportunities he's going to get. Then I want to go Girard 3 and Keeter Young 4.
That's the same list I have. I agree Talich is the clear choice for number 1. I think Greathouse, at least if he is healthy and they make a deep playoff run, we've seen him put up that type of production. Keeter Young is a distant. I could see Teddy Girard coming in and mop up duty and getting to throw some passes in a really big game because they want to see what he has. But I need to see a lot more from Keeter Young before I think he can score 5 touchdowns.
5's a lot because Aeneas Williams can score 10 rushing touchdowns, and then you have CJ Carr scoring. It's just 5's a lot. He would have to win a role that is going to be hard to win to get 5 rushing touchdowns. I actually might go Greathouse 1. If he plays 12 games, he should get 30 catches. Now, last year he played 4 games and had 8. So I guess I shouldn't say that, but I feel like I'll go Greathouse 1. But yeah, Luke Talich could end up with like 4 picks and 1 sack and not get this. But Luke Talich is going to be in position. For people not listening, Luke Talich is kind of working in that KVA package role until KVA is back. So he should be good there. Ted, I was trying to figure out, did like Kenny Minchie was the third string quarterback in 2024. Did he throw a touchdown? He ran one.
I don't believe so.
I don't think so.
He ran one in against Purdue, maybe, because everybody did. That was original Purdue, not even Red Purdue.
That could be. I think I remember like Angeli threw one a couple, maybe when he was the number 2. So I think I'm projecting Girard as maybe he's like 2A or something. So he gets a little bit of work.
Our next question is from Irish from A2. RJ Oben is the definition of a one-hit wonder, having made one big play in his career at Notre Dame on the biggest stage. What other one-hit wonder players do you remember at Notre Dame, and what was the play that they made?
So I had a hard time with like a singular play, but like the two one-hit wonders that came to mind, and one of them was, this sounds bizarre because the guy had the, I think, career record for consecutive starts, is Maurice Crum at UCLA in 2007, because he was like a good player, good college player, not pro material, would not play on this team. And he was like freaking Ray Lewis in his prime at UCLA. It was like one of the most incredible performances I've ever seen. And then one performance that felt like a one-hit wonder at the time so much, you're like, what are they doing with this guy? Was also from that same season, ironically. Golden Tate at Purdue in 2007.
Oh, in that day, yeah.
Yeah, I think he recorded, it was like 3 catches for 100 yards or something, and then he had 3 catches the rest of the season on a team that had a lot of problems. You're just like, why can't they get this guy on the field? And then a year later, they're like, oh yeah, okay, he's fine. Not really a one-hit wonder. But I just remember that Purdue performance and asking Weiss all season, like, what's with Golden Tate? Why can't you get him on the field? And they're like, we don't know. And then a year later, it was like, oh yeah, you're an All-American.
Do you remember the shirt the students made for Golden Tate? It was like
Golden is thy Tate? Or?
Yeah, but no, that was a better one. It was a play drawn up, and on the left side, it would just had number 23 or X's, and it was just a go route, a straight route to throw it to him. But yeah, that was with Evan Sharpley coming in instead of Jimmy Clausen. Sharpley threw those balls to Golden Tate against Purdue. That was fun. All right. George West, one end around against Purdue, I believe was his only touchdown as a freshman. George West, of course, works at the university now. That was his lone touchdown. It was like it was not the home opener, but it was in September because they played Purdue. I was going to say Adrian Jarrell, but he was a three-hit wonder because Adrian Jarrell caught a touchdown to beat Michigan in the 1990 opener, the Rick Meyer game. Then the next week, he caught the immaculate deflection to set up the winning touchdown at Michigan State. And then I forgot that Adrian Jarrell moved a punter and scored on a end-around as a wide receiver versus Florida State in the 93 game. So I apologize to Adrian Jarrell. He is an all-time three-hit wonder. That's pretty impressive. The only thing I could think of, Pete, was kind of along your lines, was he was a starter. He had a decent career. But in the Bettis Sugar Bowl, the famous Sugar Bowl with Jerome Bettis, Rod Smith had 18 tackles at safety.
Oh.
That's a day. And he went to the NFL. But he was like one of those first guys where you're like, Notre Dame had just excellent safeties and corners for two straight years, and all of a sudden Rod Smith was in, you're like, he's not as good as everybody said he was going to be. He was super fast. Like, he was on track with Rocket, but he became a normal everyday human, and that's when everything started going downhill a little bit. But Rod Smith was a one game huge wonder.
The only one I want to add is also from that Georgia game, and that's Jaden Harrison with the touchdown coming in at Notre Dame specifically. He was a preseason All-American special teams player, didn't do that much. He did have one receiving touchdown, I think that's against Virginia that year, and a 21-point win. So didn't do absolutely nothing, but I think in terms of what we thought he would add to that team, he really had that one big moment.
I mean, it's the biggest special teams play, in, other than Mitch Jeter's kicks, in 25 years for Notre Dame, because it mattered a lot more than all the other ones. That's a good question, though. I think I can find a couple more one-hit wonders, but George West, one touchdown. I was going to say David Grimes with his catch that was overturned against Stanford, because it was the best catch I've ever seen that didn't count, but he actually had a starting career for Notre Dame. Next question, JZuber3K. I see a lot of above-average to good talent at receiver, but does Notre Dame have a true number one for 2026? And, more importantly, does this even matter?
I don't know if they do, but last year I would say they definitely didn't. And this year I'd say, like, maybe they do. So I think they're better. I do think it matters, though, especially in December and January.
I agree it matters. And I'm pretty bullish on Jordan Faison, especially him giving up lacrosse. I think I've staked a lot of my reputation on him being really good this year. So I'm not going to back off that.
Like being an E.S. Williams, potential. Thank God he stayed.
Yeah. And yeah, I think it matters. You see teams that go to the championship game and stuff, like, they have really good receiver play.
I do think it matters in December. I don't think it matters the regular season for Notre Dame. I mean, they can beat Miami if Jordan Faison's not a true number one that day. But I do think it matters in the playoff, and I don't think they have one. But they might have, by the time November rolls around, pretty impressive list of number twos, which with CJ Carr is a number one quarterback. And that can help guys play above their level of, like, if you're a true number one wide receiver. So I guess it doesn't matter that much. Like, I'd rather have a good stable of receivers than Notre Dame 2023 plus a number one to go through the season. And I think that's what, like, remember, so you're thinking, like, freshman Flores, Tobias Merriweather, bringing up Jordan Faison from the scout team and a number
one. They didn't even have any number two receivers on that team.
No, I think they have plenty of number two possibilities on this team. Next question is from Kevin O'Neill. When Ashton Craig returns healthy, has there been any talk of moving him or Joe Otting to right guard, especially given Rudolph's predisposition to play the best five?
I haven't heard that, but I mean, Joe Rudolph has surprised us before. So I guess I wouldn't rule it out, but it seems unlikely to me.
I think it depends on the timing of when Craig actually gets back and where they are too. And what Matty Augustine and Sullivan Abstrom, how they're looking at guard and things like that. I do think Craig, at least from a size perspective, he's not a Zeke Corral or a Cam Heron where his only position would have to be center. He is big enough. And I think there's potential for that. But I think if he's back, for instance, at the start of fall camp and early August, then they're probably going to work him at center and let him compete for that job. But maybe if things are gelling one way and they don't think they're going to have Jagasaw back for a while and neither of those other two are working out at right guard, maybe they try and shuffle some things and see what he could add there.
Yeah, I think the only way this happens is if Craig eases back into it in game three and Otting does really well in game one and two. You go with Craig and you don't love what Abshire or Matty Augustine has done. But that's a lot to happen to get Otting to own the center role over Craig, who they really like. I mean, Notre Dame staff really likes Ashton Craig. And I think Matty Augustine's the intrigue here, not Otting at right guard. I don't know why Otting would be, I'm not even considering Otting at right guard. The only consideration would be Otting is at center. They need to work something in. They don't want to take him out. And it'd be Ashton Craig fighting there.
I agree. Our next question is from Irish Crunk. Does a playoff quarterfinals loss qualify as underachieving for this year's team?
I say yes.
100%.
Yes.
Without equivocation.
I don't think a semifinal loss does, because if you just say Notre Dame plays Texas in the semifinal and they lose 27-24 on a kick, they had a good year, and it's just disappointing, but it's not under.
Yeah. There's the difference between disappointing season and underachieving season.
Right.
If you lost in the final four, that would be disappointing. If you didn't make the final four at all, that would be underachieving.
Another way of looking at it is if they lose in the quarterfinals, let's just say they have to play a first round game for the point of this argument, okay? They'd be 2-1 against Pierce on the season. They would have beaten Miami and a team that comes to Notre Dame Stadium. And then you lose. That's not enough.
It's why last year's team was great and they could have done it. They also went 1-2 in games of consequence.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
So like they underachieved.
Next question from Kay Beasley. Recently, Phil Steele put 6 ND players on various All-American teams. One was, by the way, was Charles Jagasa. It got me thinking, what is the most in the modern era that ND has placed someone on one of the 5 used for unanimous or consensus All-American teams? And the second part of that question, guys, would it take a 1-seed or deep playoff run for ND to break that mark?
I think most of those are done, or all of them are done before the playoff, but I think a 1-seed would be in contention. It was hard to go too far back, but in 2020, they did have 5 guys on the first or second team. 2 were consensus, I believe, in Liam Eichenberg and Jeremiah Owusu-Koramoah, and then also you had Aaron Banks. Kyle Hamilton was on a bunch of them, and Kyron Williams was at least on a second team for the Sporty News. So you'd 5 there. I don't know if there's another list, but to get really high, you have to go way farther back in terms of just a bunch of consensus All-Americans. But yeah, I think they would need to be pushing number one. And it's worth noting that Phil Steele had 4 All-American teams, and most of those that you're talking about for consensus All-American go 1 or 2. They're not going to go to 4 teams. Maybe they have an honorable mention, but definitely not that deep in terms of what they actually offer at the end of the year.
I remember the 88 team had 3 first team in Stams, Stonebreaker, and Andy Heck. You would have had, off the top of my head, you would have had Rice would not have been, even though he played his best in big games, but the Heisman finalists were Steve Walsh, Rodney Peete, and Troy Aikman. So obviously Tony Rice wasn't an All-American there. You wouldn't have split the vote. I mean, Rocket, I think you probably would have had a vote for Derek Brown, even though he wouldn't have deserved it at tight end yet as a freshman because he was so popular. Pat Terrell made the second team, I think, and Zorich made the second team. So that's 5. That's 5, though. And guess what? They were undefeated. That's how those guys got named to it, because you do have to be – I think the number 1 seed or number 2 seed is a great point by Kate Beasley. That's how you get named All-American teams. Next question, Chris Scheiber. What is your thoughts on Irish wearing green becoming a yearly marketing event to make unimportant games have a theme, i.e. Louisville, by the way, very important game, Boise, Stanford, versus the green or greenish jerseys back in the day of only big games such as the 92 Sugar Bowl, 05 USC, or 23 Ohio State?
I have no thoughts on this.
I was waiting for I included it for the sarcasm, but yes.
Yeah, just, like many things, it's novel at first. And then you're just like, okay, just like, remember night games were a big deal? And I'm just like, oh, it's a night game. You know,
is that what we say, Pete? Oh, it's a night game? I don't think
That's lovely. It's a night game. Or like, I mean, even the Shamrock series, when it started, you're like, oh God, where's it going to be? Who's the next opponent? Like, what's the event? And now we're just like, okay, just announce it. So I think it's fine. It's more merch to buy. People like the green jerseys. It's, you know, at a place with traditional uniforms that don't change versus Oregon or everywhere else that does. Like, it's a kind of a fun changeup, but I think it definitely has moved out of like, this is a big game wear green type of thing. I think that we're well past that at this point.
Yeah. And Notre Dame, I think, released right after a shirt with Marcus Freeman modeling it that was green to potentially buy for that game. So that's definitely what it's become. And I will say, somebody, when I posted about this on Twitter, did ask, why not the Miami game? And I will point out that Miami also wears green. So that probably wouldn't work as well for that game in particular.
I don't mind that it's a different game because it gives people that come to that game. Miami's a harder ticket. Ohio State's the harder ticket. It gives someone that comes to the Boise State, Louisville, Stanford game something different to cheer about.
For the stadium too, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good look for that game.
It looks good.
It makes 50,000 people that only go to that one game a year enjoy. They get to go to the Irish wear green game. I actually like it better. I never liked the whole, will they wear green against USC for 10 straight years after the 05 one? I mean, it was really cool in 05. It was awesome. But you can't keep trying to manufacture it. Like, hey, you think Sharpley and those guys wanted to wear green in 07 when they were getting their absolute annihilated against USC? So I like it. And I would like to point out that Louisville is a very, very big game. And if you ask the Irish players, and look at Notre Dame's reaction to Louisville walking off the field that day, you will see exactly how big Notre Dame's players thought the Louisville game was. I just want names on jerseys, guys. That's really all that matters to me right now as I age. And also it's NIL. What's the fight against that?
I do need to some point write a story of like why you couldn't buy Jeremiah Love's jersey in the bookstore last year. It just didn't make any sense.
Next question from ATLBRY. Way too early gut feeling. Let's assume CJ Carr enters the draft. Is Notre Dame's 2027 starting quarterback on the roster?
No.
I'll say yes.
Well, interesting. I said no back in December, but I knowing Gerard would be here, so maybe January. I will say yes this time. And I do not believe the same thing JB does about having to. I mean, I think it's great if Notre Dame has CJ Carr returning. I'm not saying that. I'm saying I don't care about a homegrown quarterback, because just go look at the final four of the last 2 years of the new playoff era. They all transferred.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it worked out for Riley Leonard. Yeah.
It worked out for Will Howard. It worked out for Fernando Mendoza. I mean, it worked out really well for Carson Beck, where people like to think about it or not. I mean, they just... Julian Sain transfer, for crying out loud, if Ohio State gets to the Final Four with under Julian Sain. I don't think it matters that much. But want to be clear, returning your quarterback when he's CJ Carr is awesome, but I don't know if it needs to be homegrown. But I think one of them will impress. I think Teddy Gerrard will impress enough that they ride with it. So, Drew, you're just thinking they're going to they either win the national title or come up short? All right, let's say they win the national title. Does it change it for you versus come up short and CJ Carr leaves?
I don't think so. I mean, I was impressed with what I saw from Noah Grubbs, but partially that was because my expectations were pretty low until I actually saw him. And I mean, as impressed as I've seen some stuff from Teddy Gerrard, he still should be a high school senior coming in and doesn't have a ton of experience. Like, I think it's just a lot to ask for, even if there are some pieces I like, for them to be ready as what would be a freshman in college in Gerrard's case, in terms of his like actual development and age. So I just not sure. I'm willing to bet on that when we've seen Notre Dame have a definite willingness to go get a transfer. And now they're very willing to pay for those type of things too.
I mean, as the questioner at like gut feeling, we don't know. I don't think the staff knows unless they've already seen the only way the staff would know is if they've seen enough of Hebert, Grubbs and Gerrard to be like, whoa, which I don't think is the case, because they haven't had enough time to really evaluate them. I think they like what they've seen from Grubbs so far. We'll see. Like, the idea they couldn't have a read on Gerrard at this point, but you got to have a read by November 1st. Because if you're like, this ain't it, you got to be prepared to go big in December and get somebody else. So that's the big, big summer. And the first 2 weeks of August, I think, are critical for Notre Dame sort of figuring this stuff out.
And I think I know that there's no real cap here, but I think there's a tough job. I mean, Notre Dame goes to the national championship game. Let's just do that. Win or lose. Guys are going pro. They have a chance to go pro. That makes more guys go pro, which means you're paying for more players, which means you maybe don't put $4 million into your transfer quarterback. You can get a transfer linebacker, a transfer corner, a transfer defensive end. I think that could be part of it. Drew, I like it though. I like the contrarian look, because that's always been me, to just go get one in the portal. But I don't know. That's that the quarterback price has gone so high. Like, Sam Hartman and Riley Leonard were the biggest bargains in the world compared to what you're paying now.
Yeah,
that wouldn't get you a 5-star high school prospect.
Yeah, you couldn't. Everybody was aghast that Sam Hartman was getting $1.2 million or whatever. That would do nothing for you now. So yeah. I don't. I think it's tougher with the payments.
I think if Gerrard were just a year older or a year more, like, I would be a lot more comfortable, but I'm just not certain about that. And he is as good as I think he is. It's not like he was the number one quarterback prospect in the country.
Right. It's not like it's CJ Carr that is returning and why they didn't go after a quarterback. I mean, CJ Carr was different. You knew CJ. They knew what they had in CJ Carr before he stepped on campus.
Yeah, that's. And like, by the way, it would be great for Notre Dame if the answer was yes. Great. Because then you know you've got something and you're saving a lot of money.
And that's all we care about, is saving Notre Dame's money. On this podcast. Final question from East Tex 903. When was the last time Notre Dame entered a season ranked number one? Who was the last preseason number one team that actually went on to win the national championship? Go ahead, Drew.
You do on the top. I think it doesn't matter if Notre Dame's preseason number one. The last time it happened was 1971. So that means their last four national championships, they were in 1966, they were sixth before the season. 73, they were eighth. 1977, they were third. 1988, they were 13th. And then they didn't start doing preseason polls for the AP until 1950. So all Notre Dame's championships in the 40s and before didn't have a preseason ranking. They probably would have been. They were so dominant in the 40s, I'm sure they would have been. But I think the point is it doesn't necessarily happen that often. And in Notre Dame's case, it hasn't happened in any of our lifetimes.
Pete, last preseason team, you know this one. I'm going to ask a couple questions.
Yeah, I think it was Alabama 17. So yeah, it's been a minute on that, which I guess was, but ultimately, I'm not sure that was all that surprising. Like, college football is a weird sport. And like, if you can take the preseason number one, or you can bet the field, I'm betting the field every single time. Yeah. I just don't think there's much correlation about like how it's going to end based on how you started.
04 USC was one where you might not want to bet the field quite as much back then with the Leinart Bush team returning. As Drew pointed out, 99 Florida State was the one I guessed with that whole group coming back. And then 93, of course, Florida State, which they won the national championship when they were number one and then came through. But I have a quick addendum for people that were wondering how it was that long ago. In 1981, Jerry Faust's first year, Notre Dame was number seven. They beat LSU and were elevated to number one. Those were different days, and proceeded to go 5-6 on the season. In 1989, Notre Dame was preseason number two, won the kickoff classic, and then they were number one for the Michigan-Notre Dame game, 1-2, which is awesome to do that. So flip, basically Michigan's idol flipped with Notre Dame. That's the rocket, two returns. And in 1990, after they beat Michigan, who was, I think, number three at the time, but it was a good, Notre Dame went to number one there as well. So it's really more important to be ranked number one sometime in September than preseason.
I would have thought that 24 Ohio State could have been preseason number one, because that was a championship team or bust. But in the AP poll, they were actually preseason number two behind Georgia.
You know, beat
Georgia. And usually, if you're preseason number one, usually you do pretty well. The last team, USC in 2012, went unranked, but the rest of them, except for, well, Texas last year finished 12th, but everybody in between finished seventh or better. I think four or five of those were finished second. So usually they still do pretty well. So it's not a bad thing to be preseason number one. But to your guys' point, there's a lot of chaos. There are a lot of things that go into getting 18 to 22-year-olds ready to play college football.
Totally forgot USC 2012 was number one. That is nuts. Is it because of Woods and Lee? Is that what that was?
It wasn't because of Max Whittick.
It wasn't because of Max Whittick at the end of that thing. They came to play that day. They just had Max Whittick. We don't come to play again. On Monday, June 12th, that is also a decision day for Irish legacy wide receiver Julius Jones. Until then, for Pete Sampson of The Athletic, Drew Mentock of Irish Illustrated, I'm Tim O'Malley. Thank you for watching and listening, Irish Illustrated Insider.